everyone. Welcome to episode 41 of All Crime, No Cattle. This is Aaron.
And I'm Shay.
And this episode marks the final episode of 2018. But we do have a couple extra things in store for you all before we get back from the break. The first one is going to be our extra special anniversary episode coming out on the 20th. So that's just in a couple of days. And that marks our first anniversary as a podcast.
We did it. We finally made it. It's like a marathon where you're rounding the final turn and you can see the finish line and everybody cheering. That's what we're looking at right now.
That's right. And so that episode is going to have some listener questions, like an AMA type thing. We're going to be reading a few listener stories, some listener feedback. We're going to be doing a few little mini Texas cases, some fun ones to round out the year. And we're going to be doing our blooper reel.
Oh my gosh, I can't wait for the blooper reel. It's so good.
It's my favorite thing that's ever happened.
We've been building it for a while, and every time we get down on the podcast, Aaron will just be like, play the blooper reel. And we laugh and laugh. I hope you guys enjoy it.
Yeah.
I'm really excited to show it to you.
Yeah, we've been building that since probably about episode 6 or 7,
I would say. Yeah, something like that.
So it's been a long time coming. In fact, we probably need to cut a lot out.
No, it's perfect.
And then after that, of course, later this month, we will be having our Patreon special episode as well. That's going to be a doozy. It's going to be a weird tree-related crime.
Tree-related crime?
Oh, yes. We'll get into it.
Oh, okay. I'm intrigued.
And then after that, we'll be coming back in probably mid-January. We'll let you guys know on social media when you should be expecting our triumphant return.
Oh, yeah.
But believe me, we're going to be busy this whole time. We're not going to be really taking much of a break, per se. We have a lot to do. We have a lot on our schedule. So we'll be spending that time preparing for next year.
The research never stops.
Never stops. Never stops.
But, you know, it's going to give us some time to work on some of those bigger cases and do some really interesting, fun stuff that I'm excited to bring you guys next year.
That's right. And we're going to be teasing some of that on that anniversary special. So be sure to check that out. Now, with no further ado, Shay, you tell me you have a special Christmas themed episode for us today.
That's right, Aaron. Yep, it's episode 41 and Christmas is right around the corner. What better way to celebrate that than to give you an episode with a touch of holiday dressing to it? Not the kind of dressing that you find with your turkeys in the oven, but a little Christmas theme to go along with your true crime. So this year, I've prepared a crime from the Lone Star State that involved, you guessed it, old Saint Nick himself, and perhaps some less benevolent elves who helped him out. Specifically, I'm talking about an infamous Texas robbery that took place way out in Cisco, Texas. And we're also going to need to roll that time machine back to 1927. Yes, we are covering what I like to call the day Santa stole Christmas, but what is more popularly known as the Santa Claus robbery. So let's get through some of these sources real fast. Our main source comes to us from the book that was written about this case, The Santa Claus Bank Robbery, written by famous history writer A.C. Green, and that was written in 1972. It's a small book, but it's a great source for statements and pictures, and it's really great. You should check it out on Kindle if you can. It's not very expensive. We also use the Texas State Historical Association article written by Walter Pilcher in 2010. We use the Texas Monthly article written by Stacy Hollister, which was a really great summary article from 2002. We used an article from our local paper, the Fort Worth Weekly, and that was written by Carlton Stowers in 2007. We also used a collection of other articles from around 2017 from Wide Open Country, KTXS 12 News, BigCountry.com, and we also used a little TV snippet from one of those historical retrospective segments, and that was put out by KTAB TV Abilene. It covers the case really well, and it gives you some of the interviews from back in the 80s of people that were still alive at the time who were at the scene in 1927. I also used some information from Cisco Chamber of Commerce's archives to help build the setting. And I also used findagrave.com. So first off, let's start as we always do with a new location and talk a little bit about Cisco, Texas back in the 1920s. Cisco, Texas sits about halfway between two larger Texas towns, Weatherford and Abilene.
Oh, Weatherford, where yours truly spent junior high and high school.
Oh, yeah. Would you consider that your formative years?
I mean, technically, I guess that's everybody's formative years.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah.
Oh, how do you feel about that?
Not very good. It sucks.
Go ahead and throw Weatherford right under the bus.
I'm sorry. It's a different city now than it was back 15, 20 years ago when I lived there.
Mm-hmm.
When I lived there, it was awful.
Famous for the Peach Festival, right? We've been to that.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Peach Festival is nice.
Parker County Peaches. What up? Send us some to our P.O. box. Anyways, Cisco, Texas is also about an hour and a half west of Fort Worth, so it's not too far from where we are now. It's situated in what's considered the Central Plains of Texas, and it's mainly known as great land for farming, ranching, and natural resources. The town of Cisco, Texas was founded back in 1881 on May 17th. The reason for the founding of this town was due to two major railroads that were developing westward through Texas at the time, which just so happened to cross each other at this location. So I don't know if you are up on your railroad history, Aaron, but when two big railroads during westward expansion crossed, it was a really big deal.
My master's thesis was on railroad history.
Oh, wow. Then you're very up on this topic.
I am an expert. But no, we've seen that several times, I think, going back and talking about how some of these towns in Texas began. A lot of them began at important railroad junctures.
Yep.
Just because that's where people naturally congregated for work and, you know, things of that nature.
Yeah, that's actually how Arlington, where we went to college, was founded.
Yeah.
So originally this area, before the railroad showed up, was referred to as Red Gap by local residents that formed a spread out farming and ranching community. When the two major railroads finally crossed each other, they built a train yard and a shipping hub, and then everything began to change for the citizens of Red Gap. The newly founded town was named after a famous New York developer, John A. Cisco, who was heavily tied to the shipping and railroad town investments that were popping up across the country. Investors and financiers poured into the area, and buildings such as post offices, hotels, churches, schools, general stores, even milling and processing facilities started to pop up. It didn't take long for Cisco, Texas to prosper. This was due to a focus on becoming a trade hub, but also because they were exporting their own goods like cattle, produce, grain, limestone, coal, and iron. This rapid development continued for Cisco into the Roaring Twenties when large fields of oil were discovered in the surrounding area. This is actually known as the Central Texas Oil Boom. So we know there's been several different oil booms around the state. This is the one for this region. The census records show a giant spike in population from around 2.5 thousand people in 1910 to as many as 8.5 thousand people in the 1920s. Now, this may not seem like a huge number by today's standards, but considering this was during the Texas westward expansion era, just before the Dust Bowl and the Great Depression, it actually made Cisco one of the larger cities in the western Texas frontier. To give you a perspective of like the times numbers, that would be like an eighth the size of Fort Worth during this time. So pretty big. Cisco even gained the moniker of the Gate City of the West. So why am I telling you all this information about West Texas in the 1920s? Well, it's really important for setting the scene of today's case. All this prosperity led to a really big problem during this period. So do you remember the case that I covered involving the Newton Gang?
Yeah, of course.
Well, that was back during 1919 through 1924, just before this period. The Newtons were successful bank robbers that saw an opportunity and a glaring issue in Texas. Other would-be bank robbers, like this group of outlaws, noticed this glaring opportunity too, except for their methodology was strikingly different than the gentleman robbers. This period of rapid development and growth that was going on due to this westward expansion was like blood in the water for these Texas outlaws. On the one hand, you've got this influx of settlers and investors moving further and further into the West and sort of following the railroads and the resulting pop-up small towns that were developing in their wake. And then there's a massive oil boom that hits in Central Texas just a few years later. That meant that you had a huge volume of cash and bonds flowing into the vaults of small-town Texas banks across the region. But this area had another thing going for it. Everything was pretty much undeveloped and rural land. Also, it was really spread out. So this particular climate really set up an opportunity that resulted in one of the greatest periods of bank robberies in Texas history. Just on the heels of the famed Newton Gang in 1924, the next 6 years would see a massive rise in bank robberies. It was reported in local papers that 3 to 4 Texas banks were being robbed per day in 1927.
3 to 4?
Yes.
That seems really extravagant numbers.
They are. They're ludicrous. And that's what I'm trying to tell you. This kind of climate really bred crime and was just a hunting ground for the would-be bank robber. Also, I'd like you to consider that in the early 1900s, bank robbery was made a capital offense in Texas.
Whoa, a capital offense?
Yes. There were so many bank robberies going on during this era that one of the extreme efforts that they made to stop it was to make it a capital offense.
Jeez.
Yeah, so that's why you end up having so many pictures of bank robbers in papers and at sheriff's departments hanging.
So how was that as a deterrent for the crime?
Well, as we move towards 1927, it just kind of gets worse.
Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to deter them at all. Well, due to the frequency and success of these robberies, all of the Texas banks were heavily insured, since most of them just expected to be robbed at any moment. This also added to thinking that, hey, I don't need to worry about robbing a bank. They're insured. That money's not theirs. The people who put their money in there, the farmers, the ranchers, the miners, the oil men, they're going to get their money because they're insured.
Yeah, so a lot of people, I think, talk themselves into it because it seems like a victimless crime.
Exactly. Well, wild shootouts, car chases, and townsfolk taking justice into their own hands became a daily occurrence. As a result, the Texas Bankers Association put forth an offer in the fall of 1927 to the tune of $5,000 to anyone who could confirm that they had shot a bank robber during their crime.
Whoa, $5,000 in 1927 money?
Yeah. Do you want to know how much that is actually in today's money?
Please, it's got to be an enormous amount.
That is almost $70,000.
Whoa!
In today's money.
I'd be hunting those bank robbers if I was these people.
Well, they definitely did, and that's another factor we're going to talk about. The Texas Monthly article that I used quoted that this came to be known locally as the dead robber reward. So you can start to see that with all these factors, we essentially had a recipe for disaster. Just a few months after the Texas Banker Association published this reward in the papers, tragedy struck. On December 23rd, 1927, men, women, and children were shocked in broad daylight in Cisco, Texas, by what is considered one of the bloodiest Christmases in Texas history. Even more shocking were the reports that one of the pistol-wielding bandits was dressed up as Santa Claus himself. He did have help, though. So let's dig a little bit further into Santa and his little helpers, shall we? First off, we have 24-year-old Marshall Ratliff. Out of the four robbers in Cisco, Texas that fateful day, Ratliff was considered to be the mastermind of this particular bank heist. He was handsome, charismatic, confident, and brash. Not much is known about Marshall Ratliff's early years, but we do know that he grew up idolizing the outlaw culture of the day. Other criminals who spent time with him in Huntsville gave statements regarding Ratliff's lifelong obsession with bank robbery. A few years before the bank robbery in Cisco, Ratliff had been caught with his brother Lee after robbing a nearby bank in Valera, Texas, and making off with $3,000 worth of cash. Now, in today's money, that would be a whopping almost $42,000.
That's pretty nice payday.
Yeah, I mean, that's some people's whole salary they get in a year. Well, Marshall and Lee Ratliff were later tracked down by Cisco Chief of Police G.E. Bit Bedford once he received the robbers' descriptions from the Valera Sheriff's Office. Marshall and Lee were known troublemakers and criminals in Cisco, so it wasn't that difficult to figure out who had committed the robbery once they had the description. Marshall and Lee were both convicted and sentenced to 18 years in Huntsville State Penitentiary. They served a little over a year of their sentences before being pardoned by then-Governor Miriam A. Ferguson. I searched a lot as to how and why they were pardoned. Kind of like Willis Newton. You know how he was writing the governor letters and falsifying documents? I couldn't find any of that information in this case.
Yeah, that's pretty incredible to be sentenced to 18 years and only serve one.
Yeah, I don't know if this was kind of the laissez-faire attitude of the day to just pardon bank robbers because there were so many of them. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean, they had that $5,000 a head bounty on robbers, so you'd think that they would take it a lot more seriously as far as keeping them in jail goes.
Yeah, you would think, because if you're going to pardon them that quickly, you'd think they'd go right back to a life of bank robbery. Of course, after they were lucky enough to receive their freedom via a pardon, that's exactly what they did, Aaron. They went straight back to the criminal drawing board and hatched a plan to rob the First National Bank back in their hometown of Cisco, Texas. You see, Marshall Ratliff wanted a do-over, but this time he planned to make sure to get the formula right. Marshall Ratliff was not like the Newton Gang, you know, the gentleman robbers. He planned to show force, go in and come out guns a-blazin', shooting anyone that got in his way, and to mainly strike fear in the heart of the Cisco citizens while robbing them blind.
So this is a town of, what did you say at this point, about 8,000 people?
Yeah, 8,000 or 9,000, yeah.
And this is a town that he grew up in?
That he was living in for a while.
Still, I mean, you'd think that he'd know a lot of people. I mean, is that kind of his reasoning? Like, I'm going to be seen while I do this, so I'm going to take anybody out who might see me and might be able to identify me?
I think that's part of it, and I think that's also part of his disguise that we're going to see later. So this was all going pretty good in the planning process, up until this early hiccup where his brother Lee gets arrested for a separate charge and heads back to prison. But that didn't stop Ratliff. He didn't abandon his plans. He instead decided to reach out to some ex-cons that he had met while serving time in Huntsville, and that was Henry Helms and Robert Hill. They all joined forces at a boarding house in Wichita Falls. That's about 2 hours north of Cisco, right along the Oklahoma border. Robert Hill was just a couple of years younger than Marshall Ratliff and was slated to be a lookout and getaway driver. Henry Helms, 32, was the wise veteran of the group. He could handle the intimidation game or any leverage that was needed if anyone got out of line. Originally, they had planned to use a fourth ex-con who was a good safecracker. But a few days before the job, he came down with a horrible case of the flu. Therefore, they convinced Lewis Davis to join the crew as their new fourth man. Lewis Davis was 28 and was a relative of Helms and a family man with no criminal background, who was desperate for money. Reportedly, Davis only agreed to the robbery when the other three promised him that there wouldn't be any shooting or bloodshed.
So were they just lying to him, or did they think that that's how it was actually going to go?
That's a good question. From everything we know about Ratliff, he seems to have an axe to grind and doesn't mind showing force, and he's kind of planning for it with the hiring of Helms.
Mm-hmm.
So I would argue that it's probably a lie.
Okay, so he was supposed to be replacing the safecracker. So did he have some kind of expertise that would help them in this job?
Nope.
Wow, seems like not a great person to join your group.
And yeah, exactly. So kind of with the safecracker, that would give you someone who could gain access to a vault or a safe via some other means besides force, and you're replacing him with someone who's never done any criminal activity. That seems to lead to the idea that there's going to have to be a use of force to gain access to money.
Yeah.
So with their four-man holiday bank robbing crew, Santa and his three messed up elves had their plot and their plan. In the early morning of December 23rd, 1927, Ratliff and the three other men stole an almost brand new blue Buick. It was a very expensive car with lots of horsepower, and it was a seemingly perfect getaway vehicle for the times. With their hot ride, they headed south to Cisco. Once they arrived in town mid-morning, Ratliff put on a Santa Claus outfit that he had borrowed from the owner of the boarding house in Wichita Falls, Midge Tallett. The purpose of the getup was mainly to hide his identity in a town very familiar with his face. But the extra irony and terror that Ratliff enjoyed was the idea of Santa robbing a bank.
So he kind of liked the irony of that? Mm-hmm. Like, he has this very dark sense of humor, and he just thought that was kind of clever of him?
Yeah. He's definitely the face of the party. And, you know, like I said, he's charismatic, he's brash. This is something that I think he enjoyed about the plan.
Hmm.
Well, the rest of the men dropped off Ratliff about two blocks from the First National Bank, and they drove the car around the back and parked in the side alley. While they were doing that, Ratliff strolled down the main streets of Cisco in his big red suit, matching hat, large pot belly, and fluffy white beard. He even waved to children, going so far as to pat some of them on their heads and tell them Merry Christmas in a husky voice. It was 2 days before Christmas, and no one batted an eye at the sight of old Saint Nick coming down the road. A few minutes later, Ratliff stood near a large clock post constructed by the First National Bank, and he waved at passersby and took children's gift requests.
Wow, so he's really going all out. Like, he is Santa Claus in this moment.
He's really taking on the role, it seems like.
You know, he should have just, like, become a mall Santa instead of robbing banks.
Well, or a strip mall Santa in this case. They didn't have malls back then, but they had plenty of stores that you could go and just take on the role of being Santa.
Yeah.
He seemed to get a kick out of it.
Saloon Santa.
Saloon Santa. I like that. There probably were saloon Santas back then.
Sounds great.
Just like drunk on whiskey and talking to weird children passing by.
I'm just trying to put that in the setting of Tombstone, where they're like playing poker.
Yeah, with the saloon piano going on in the background.
Yeah.
Well, KTAB-TV Abilene ran that short historical segment that I told you about earlier. And when they did, they were able to catch up with Lila Latch Lloyd, who was there that day. She and her younger brother were out doing some last-minute Christmas shopping when she suggested they go over and talk to Santa. Quote, "We walked up to Santa and both of us shook his hand, and Santa said, 'Well, little man, what do you want?' And my little brother replied that he wanted a football in the nearby window. He tried to pull Santa over to see the exact one that he was referring to when Santa stopped him and said, 'Sorry, young man, I have to stay here. This is my post. But I guarantee that your big sister or mom and dad, they'll get you that football.' So with that, we walked on and my brother was satisfied. After a few more minutes of fielding requests for gifts, Ratliff made his way into First National Bank and into the lobby. 6-year-old Francis Blassingame eyed Santa as he left the clock and moved into the bank. She turned to her mother, asking if they could go talk to Santa so she could submit one final Christmas wish. Her mother, B.P. Blassingame, gave in to her daughter's wishes and walked her across the road into First National. Meanwhile, once Ratliff entered the lobby, he headed for the table where you find the deposit slips. You know the place. It's typically over to the side where you get in line, and he pulled out one of those slips and began to start filling it out. One of the nearby tellers called out to him, saying, "Hello, Santa." He ignored her. Ratliff finished up filling out his slip and headed for a teller window. Again, the teller said, "Hello, Santa." But Santa looked right through her with no reaction. As the teller stood, staring at Santa Claus, wondering if something was wrong with the man, 3 other men entered the bank and immediately pulled out firearms. They declared that this was a robbery, and they started corralling patrons and the security guards over into one side of the bank. As 6-year-old Francis and B.P. Blassingame walked into the front doors of First National Bank in search of Santa, they found instead a full-blown armed bank robbery in progress.
Oh, God, that is so terrifying.
Well, BP thought so, too. She immediately grabbed her daughter and turned to run back out the front door. But one of the armed men had moved in front of that main door and was now staring her down. BP, thinking quickly and moving out of, I'm sure, sheer terror, took off for the alleyway door that she knew was in the back of the bank. Multiple men shouted at BP to stop, or they would shoot. But she didn't. She paid them no attention, and she kept running. She hit that alley door moving as fast as she could with her daughter at her side. From there, they began running and shouting their way to the nearby police station. They shouted things like, "They're robbing the bank! Someone help!"
Okay, so they're okay?
Yeah.
Oh, I was so nervous that they were going to shoot and kill them. Oh, gosh. Okay, good.
But what a close call, right?
Yeah. Okay, so now that they've alerted the authorities, well, so now things are really going to start getting squirrely, I would imagine.
Well, remember, the police station is a couple of blocks away, but their initial shouting of that they're robbing the bank, someone help us, that was a call to help to nearby citizens.
Oh, and we've got that dead robber reward.
That's right.
So it means everybody's going to be pulling out their weapons saying, "Ah, I've got my own payday."
A lot of people think that that is a giant factor in the events that are about to transpire.
Ooh.
So citizens nearby either drew their weapons that they had on them or they ran to retrieve them. Some men even headed over to the nearby hardware store to purchase a rifle or a pistol and returned back to the area in and around the bank to form what would become the impromptu Cisco Bank Robber Posse.
Oh man, that doesn't seem like a great idea.
It seems like a scene that you would see in an Old West movie where everyone's laying in wait and there's like a guy in a barrel with a gun, you know.
I mean, this sounds like a movie.
Mm-hmm.
This sounds absolutely preposterous.
Well, meanwhile, back in the bank, Ratliff is in and among the chaos of the robbery. He quietly strolls into the teller's cage and began to pull out potato sacks from under the iconic red coat of Santa. He tossed them at the clerks and the tellers, and according to reports by the Texas Monthly article, he demanded they, quote, fill them with cash, checks, and bonds until they're ready to bust. Any other valuables that the bank had, he wanted. Once the sacks were full, Ratliff transferred them to a larger bag. I'm guessing this is Santa's veritable bag of gifts. In total, the big bag held $12,000 in cash and $150,000 worth of bonds.
Wow, that is a lot of money for back then.
Yes.
I mean, that's a lot of money today.
Oh, yeah. And in today's money, it's around about $2.25 million.
Why did they just have $2.25 million in things lying around? I mean,
like I said, it's a prosperous area. There's not a lot of big banks. This is a national bank. So a lot of people felt comfortable keeping their money there.
Wow.
What Ratliff and the others didn't know, though, was that Mrs. Blassingame and her daughter had not only alerted the civilians nearby, but had in fact reached the Cisco police station to alert Chief of Police G.E. Bit Bedford. You know, the guy who originally arrested Marshall Ratliff just a few years earlier?
Oh.
Yeah. Bedford armed himself and a few deputies and rushed over to the bank. He directed two of his deputies to station themselves near the rear alley exit, and Bedford headed to cover the main entrance of the building. Now, this particular part of the crime gets a little fuzzy, as everything happened really quickly, there was a lot of confusion, and a lot of the accounts begin to differ as to who shot first, what happened first, that kind of thing. Most accounts, though, seem to agree that when Chief Bedford went to look in the front main window to kind of assess the scene, he was likely spotted by one of the robbers, and shots began to ring out. The main front window shattered. Bedford returned fire, and then men, women, and children began to scream. At this point, all hell broke loose. The Cisco posse of armed citizens began to open fire, and return shots came back from inside the bank via the four robbers. All the while, there's innocent civilians inside the bank.
Yeah.
Moments later, in the middle of this chaotic gunfight that lasted minutes, the back alley door flew open. Out poured innocent people who had been inside the bank during the robbery, as well as the bandits themselves. The four bank robbers hid themselves inside this crowd of people, and they began shooting from within the crowd while holding on to hostages in front of them.
Oh.
Yeah. Two of the hostages were little girls named Laverne Comer and Emma Mae Robertson, 12 and 10 years old. The nearby posse of armed civilians were drawn to the sound of gunfire in the side alley. They moved over and began shooting wildly down the alley. Meanwhile, deputies that were posted at the other end of the alley were attempting to return fire on the four robbers, but not shoot innocent bystanders or children. This resulted in a terrible case of crossfire. So you've got the posse on one end of the alley shooting, deputies on the other, and robbers in the middle shooting both ways. Some of the hostages were wounded as they emerged out of the alley, including Alex Spears, the bank president, who was shot through the face.
Oh.
So in this case, in total, you had six people that were killed, including the two police officers, Carmichael and Chief Bedford, and eight others were injured as a result of this robbery.
So six people died in this. So I'm assuming one of them was the bank president.
Yep. A couple of bystanders and a couple of hostages. And a couple of posse members. That makes all of them.
Wow, that's a lot of death.
Yeah. A lot of people were just shot, too.
Wow. So this was, I mean, this is really a gunfight.
Oh, yeah. It's a Texas gunfight. Lead flying, blood being spilt. It's mayhem.
Wow.
Well, O.L. Stamley, a Cisco resident, was at the bank that day, and he told KTAB News, quote, "The killings were senseless, but you know, that was the way we handled things in those days. To stop whatever started any way you could," end quote. Though we might think this scene sounds ludicrous, Stamey's comments remind us how different things were back then. One of the people that was killed that day was Chief Bedford. He was the beloved chief of the town. Everyone had good things to say about him. But Stamey in this interview goes on to suggest why he thinks Chief Bedford actually died. He says, quote, "You know, Chief Bedford was a big man. He was a great chief and everybody loved him. But unfortunately, he was a hard target to miss. Deputy Carmichael, who was also shot, was a big man too. And they made good targets for those bandits. That's the only reason them robbers shot him." So Chief Bedford and Deputy George Carmichael were both mortally wounded at the scene. Bedford died several hours later from a fatal shot to the chest. Carmichael held on until January 17th when he eventually succumbed to multiple injuries, including a shot to the head.
Oh, wow.
As the hostages began to scatter, the four bank robbers threw the two little girls, their big bag of loot, and themselves into the dark blue Buick, and they blasted out of the alley. They turned onto Main Street and headed southbound.
Wow, what real pieces of garbage. You have, first of all, I mean, just get in the car and go. I mean, you don't need to have hostages with you at that point to begin with, but the ones that you choose are two little girls.
Yeah, I think that probably it was because they were easy to handle and manage. They were probably the most scared.
Sure, but also I would imagine they know that that's going to be the best advantage that they have, because hopefully people will stop shooting at them if they know that they have the two little girls in that car.
Well,
where maybe a posse might be a little, you know, gung-ho if it's just an adult. Oh, well, they're just going to be taken out too. No biggie.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's what the bank robbers were thinking. But the posse kept shooting. Even as the car rounded the corner and headed out on Main Street, Jasper Cook told A.C. Green, who wrote the book, that when he was a seventh grader, he was there on the street as the car came out of the alley and headed southbound on Main Street. And he remembers just how angry the mob had become. And a lot of people out on the street didn't know that they had two little girl hostages in the car. Quote, "They were angry. They wanted justice and to save as many people from getting further harm as possible. They got out as many men and vehicles as they could to chase after them bandits. They were hanging off of those cars. We had running boards back in those days. Carloads of them were headed southbound down Main Street. And of course, you could still hear shooting for several minutes as they went," end quote.
Yeah, well, I'm sure that they're also enraged because they know the chief of police has been shot pretty badly. You know, obviously, he's not dead at this point, but he's horribly injured, and the other deputy. And then there's all of these other people who have been shot and are hurt and injured, and they're freaking out. And so I bet to some degree these people all saw red.
Yeah, they're whipped up into a fury.
Yeah, especially if they were already ready to shoot somebody to begin with before all of that happened.
Well, estimates were made that there were at least 200 bullet holes in the bank and another 50 to 100 in the getaway car.
Wow.
That's the kind of shooting that went on in those few minutes. It was amazing that more innocent lives weren't taken that day. We're talking about a couple handfuls of people, but, you know, with that amount of firepower and bullets flying everywhere, it's amazing one of those little girls didn't get shot.
Yeah.
So let's get back to what's going on in this blue Buick. Because I can tell you're interested. It's now riddled full of bullet holes, and Ratliff, Helm, and Davis were all injured. Lewis Davis had been shot multiple times and didn't look like he was going to make it. Remember, he was the family man who only signed on because they agreed there wasn't going to be any shooting and no one was going to get hurt.
God, of course, like the one guy with half a brain and seems like an okay guy, you know, is the one that's horrifically injured in all this.
Yeah. Unfortunately, December 23rd, 1927 was his first and seemingly last day in his criminal career. Well, as they blazed through Cisco, they hit the city limits and then they were out of town into the countryside. That's when they realized a terrible fatal flaw in their plan. They had neglected to fill up the gas tank of their getaway car before the robbery.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Maybe they got like really excited to get the robbery going and get out of there. before thinking, hey, we should fill up the car. They were now running out of fuel at the worst possible time. With an angry mob bearing down on them, the four men then decided to try and commandeer another vehicle that was coming the other way down the road, hopefully one with fuel. The one they chose, though, was an Oldsmobile belonging to a local family from the area. 14-year-old Woody Harris was driving when he was forced to pull over at gunpoint. Yeah, I said that right. 14-year-old Woody Harris was driving.
Yeah. Was that legal back then?
I don't know.
I mean, were there even regulations on it, I wonder?
Could he see over the dash of an Oldsmobile?
Yeah, 14? those are boats of cars.
Dude, they were big old bucket truck kind of cars.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, luckily for Woody Harris, he pocketed the keys from the car and fled on foot. So the four robbers transferred their hostages, their bag of loot, and themselves, including someone who is fatally injured, to the new car, only to learn that it's completely useless. So they have to turn around and do it all over again.
Do you think he did that intentionally, or do you think that was just force of habit? Like, he wasn't even really thinking, I'm going to screw these guys over.
That's an interesting question, because you always take your keys out when you get out of the car, right?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's chalked up in all the articles as, you know, a moment of genius on his part, but that's an interesting point.
Well, who knows? I mean, yeah. If I were him, I would be telling people I meant to do it. So, hey.
So now they have this completely useless vehicle with no keys, and there's a posse drawing near, coming over the horizon, and they scramble back into the original blue Buick with no gas, and they end up leaving mortally injured Lewis Davis in the car with the bag of cash and bonds.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
So they left the guy behind, but they also, forgot all of the money? The whole reason why all of this happened?
Yep. And it was a little bit down the road, and they came to this realization, and they started cussing at each other.
Oh, my.
Yeah. Well.
Dude, this is a, like, black comedy.
It's kind of like Raising Arizona.
Yeah.
We've talked about that movie before on the show.
Yeah. This is insane.
By the time the mob found Davis, he was unconscious. And then they discovered that the money was in the Oldsmobile. And this temporarily pauses the chase. Then the posse still thinks, oh, we got to see if they have anybody with them. Because some of the posse members are saying that they think somebody's with them. Some of them are saying that they're alone. And that kind of causes a delay in the chase.
Well, what about the little girl's parents?
Well, again, those people are back in town. You know, they're not part of this armed posse group in trucks.
No, understandably. But, I mean, wouldn't they have been like, hey, they took my little girl? Or just in the mix-up, did they not see that happening? I mean, with all the craziness going on.
It becomes clear that there are two little girls that are hostages. But I think that information is at the back of this posse train.
Yeah, it's not forward. Like they have cell phones to distribute this information.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, Davis ended up dying later that night at a Fort Worth hospital from the result of multiple gunshot wounds. So the remaining robbers that are left soon abandon the bullet-ridden, fuel-less Buick, as well as the two little girls several miles down the road, and continue on foot. So the little girls are safe. When the posse shows up, they find them sitting in the blue Buick.
Oh, thank God. You're seriously scaring me with some of these things. I thought something was going to happen to those poor little girls.
It's a terrifying case. You got to pull the heartstrings a little bit because everybody in the setting is terrified of the same things that we're hearing about.
Well, I was so nervous that posse was going to catch up to them and just riddle the whole car with bullets.
Well, Ratliff, Helms, and Hill evaded authorities for another 48 hours by stealing various vehicles. Yeah, three other cars. One of which they commandeered a vehicle, kept the driver at gunpoint, had him drive them around, and then got out and left him with his vehicle and took off. Their progress was slowed due to their various wounds. You know, two of them have been shot. They hadn't eaten in a couple of days. And the weather changed to an icy, sleety condition that was not conducive for them driving around in these old-timey cars.
Yeah, and guess what else? They don't have any money.
Yeah.
So,
they don't.
Like, how are they going to put themselves up or do anything?
Maybe by gunpoint, because at this point they still have a crap ton of pistols and ammunition. Well, eventually the threesome was ambushed by Sheriff Foster of Young County at South Bend as they tried to cross the Brazos River. He was expecting them to head that way. This is sort of on their way back to the Wichita Falls area where they started. So here, another car chase ensues. It resulted in another shootout, which terminated in a field, and the three of them trying to make their escape on foot again. Ratliff is hit multiple times and falls to the ground, resulting in his capture. Helms and Hill are actually both wounded, but are able to escape into the nearby woods again. 2 days later, after dodging an intense manhunt, one of the largest at the time in Texas history, which was also assisted by the use of an airplane, Helms and Hill were finally taken into custody without a fight, thanks to the tracking skills of Texas Ranger Captain Tom Hickman. So I thought that was kind of cool that a Texas Ranger was able to track them down. And it said in one of the articles I was reading that when he was tracking them, he could tell that they were about to give up because their footsteps were getting longer and longer. And at one point he could tell that they were crawling and he knew they were close.
Oh, because they were just so injured and then exhausted and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, another interesting thing is the plane. So they were trying to track them by air.
Yeah.
Like we would do in like a helicopter chase today. Mm-hmm.
And that was something we mentioned in the Newton Gang episode. So this is another case around the same time where they were trying to use small prop planes to see if they could see criminals from the air.
Oh, that's right. I remember that now. Yeah.
Well, when Texas Ranger Captain Tom Hickman caught up to Hill and Helms, Hill was still wearing three pistols and Helms was wearing four. Both still carried plenty of ammunition on them. But that was about it. Other than that, they were just covered in sleet and snow and blood. So even though Helms, Hill, and Ratliff all received several gunshot wounds, some almost fatal, they would all survive and make it to trial. Robert Hill pleaded guilty to armed robbery. He took the stand on his own behalf in March of 1928 and was sentenced to 90 years in prison. He escaped from prison on three separate occasions, only to be recaptured each time. After the last time, he decided to be a good prisoner, and he actually ended up being paroled in the 1940s. He then changed his name and became a productive citizen, and would later cooperate with A.C. Green by providing his version of the events, and in Green's book, Robert Hill wrote, quote, "I hope this book will cause young men to realize that crime does not pay." And he worked with A.C. Green on providing his version of the events. So with Robert Hill's help, A.C. Green was able to get kind of an inside perspective of how these crimes panned out. And, you know, he actually said after writing the book that Robert Hill really reformed himself. And he really felt after spending time with him that he was a better person and that he felt real guilt. He even wrote the two girls that were hostages and apologized for what happened during the events while he was in prison. That's kind of interesting. Well, let's move on to the muscle of the group, Helms. He was identified by witnesses inside the bank as the man who lethally shot both Chief Bedford and Deputy Carmichael. Helms would later receive the death sentence in late February of 1928. After an unsuccessful insanity plea, he was executed by electric chair on September 6th, 1929. His final photo is actually of him still continuing to try and plead insanity and spasming and stuff. And he actually had to be held down by jailers so that the photo could be taken.
You said that there were eyewitnesses?
Multiple people testified that he was the one who shot the chief of police and the deputy.
Were they all shooting, though?
That's a good question.
Because I just wonder, because eyewitness statements aren't obviously the best to go on in of themselves. So interesting. They were all shooting. Who really knows what happened?
Apparently, you know, they at least got a couple of witnesses to testify that they were near Helms when both the chief of police and the deputy were shot, and they claimed it was him. That's all we know. But that is interesting that you bring it up, because who was shooting and who shot who is a big question in our next trial, which is that of Marshall Ratliff. Ye old jolly Santa. Ratliff was somehow able to recover from his extreme injuries that almost killed him. And afterwards, on March 30th of 1928, he was sentenced to be executed for his role in the bank robbery and the deaths of Bedford and Carmichael. His downfall was during the testimony of 10-year-old Emma Robinson, when she identified Ratliff as the man disguised as Santa Claus who had robbed the bank and kidnapped her. He would eventually appeal his case due to the fact that no witnesses were willing to go on record stating that they had seen Ratliff fire a single shot during the entire robbery. So they couldn't find one person to say that he actually shot his gun.
You know, it's interesting because I don't think that that defense would fly today because of the law of parties, where if you're part of a group and that group kills somebody, doesn't matter if you were the one who pulled the trigger, you can still be sentenced and convicted for having part in that murder.
My question would be, was that law on the books in 1928?
That's what I'm saying. I doubt it was.
Yeah.
So that's why I was, but you know, if this happened today, I don't think there's any way any of those men would have ever gotten out of prison.
No,
you know,
stick a fork in them, you're done.
That one guy would not have been paroled, I don't think.
Well, multiple people ended up being killed. They're only really being charged for the police officers.
So what happened after his appeal?
So his original appeal with his case, due to the fact that there were no witnesses that saw him shoot a gun, that didn't go so well. The judge didn't change the sentence, didn't give him a new trial. So although his original appeal was unsuccessful, Ratliff changed to a new defense strategy by claiming mental insanity, much like Helms had attempted. This is going to be a big part of his second round of appeals. Before his second round of appeals start, one of the judges actually moves him to another facility in Eastland County, and they're going to try him there. That's where Cisco, Texas is located. So he moves him to the county jail holding facility, and there Ratliff starts to take on this new series of behaviors where he goes into these periodic catatonic states, and he forces his jailers to manually feed him and bathe him and even take him to the toilet.
Oh, God. So he's just faking it.
Yeah.
And so this is, I mean, this is what people's idea of mental illness was back then, is I'm just going to lay here glassy-eyed and people are going to think I'm crazy.
That's exactly right. Ratliff's own mother, Rhea Carter, even filed for a lunacy hearing in Huntsville, which was denied. That was a thing back then, a lunacy hearing.
What is a lunacy hearing?
Basically, it's clinically insane in today's standards, but back then they called it a lunacy hearing.
Wow.
Yeah. So once he was moved to the Eastland County Jail, he's facing his final appeal date, and that pretty much would be a nail in the coffin for his death penalty, because he's facing this mastermind charge and the murder of two men, the planning of this robbery, the taking the hostages of two little girls, and he was dead set that he was not going to go to the electric chair. Apparently, Ratliff's act and his antics started to become really convincing to his jailers, though. He actually got them to start believing that he had some kind of psychosis. Pack Kilborn and T.A. Jones, a.k.a. Uncle Tom, were the two jailers that commonly took care of Ratliff during this time. They started to feel sympathetic for him and actually kind of believed that he was mentally ill. Well, on November 18th, Ratliff decided to make his final move. After hand-feeding Ratliff a meal, Kilborn and Jones left Ratliff's cell, but left the cell door open, believing Ratliff's act that he was in a weird paralysis.
Oh my God.
They then moved along to the rest of the cell block to take care of the other prisoners. Meanwhile, Ratliff snuck out of his cell, silently moved downstairs to the jailhouse office. There, he managed to get a hold of a revolver in one of the desks. He loaded it, and then went back upstairs, snuck up behind the unassuming jailers for a lethal attack. He fired the revolver and fatally wounded Jones. Kilborn reacted quickly. He turned around, shocked, saw the danger, and immediately tackled Ratliff. They violently fought for control of the pistol, wrestling down the hallway, and at one point they even tumbled down the steel staircase into the jailhouse office. These are solid steel stairs.
Yikes.
That was probably not fun to roll down.
Yeah.
As they tumbled down these steel stairs, Ratliff ended up firing a few stray shots, and one of the bullet holes in the jailhouse to this day has one of the bullets embedded in it.
Wow.
Yeah. With people looking on helplessly from the front windows who had heard the gunfire, Kilborn was able to beat Ratliff into submission, take the gun away, and return him to his cell. By the time he made it back to Jones, he was dead.
Wow. So I'm assuming that didn't do much for his insanity appeal.
It sure didn't, because after rumors began to spread of Ratliff's failed escape attempt and the murder of Tom Jones, a crowd began to gather the next morning outside of the jailhouse. And by nightfall, it had grown to over 1,000 people. Quickly, the gathering turned into a bloodthirsty mob. They began demanding Ratliff to be turned over them for a good old-fashioned hanging. Kilborn, the only jailer left in the jailhouse, refused and tried to reason with the mob, pleading with them to let justice take its course. Unfortunately, Kilborn was overpowered, and the mob rushed into the jailhouse and dragged the pleading Ratliff from his cell. They then tied his hands and feet and attempted to hang him at the nearest utility pole. The first attempt to hang him failed when the rope broke, and Ratliff fell to the ground. A second rope was quickly procured, though, and this time the hanging was a success. Ratliff was pronounced dead at 9:55 p.m. on November 19th, 1929. The rope that didn't break, that was actually used to hang him, along with some other artifacts of the event, still sit in the Eastland County Jailhouse, which is now a museum. Yeah, he actually has his intake papers that are there where he signed his name, and you can see, like, they have it all laminated, and there's some of the other artifacts that are there. It's kind of cool looking. His body was buried in Fort Worth at a family plot at Olivet Cemetery, and I'm curious if the marker's still there.
I don't know. That'd be interesting to figure out.
Yeah, apparently he had family ties back in Fort Worth.
Probably the people of Cisco didn't want him buried there.
Oh, yeah, I betcha.
Yeah. A town like that, there's probably one cemetery. So I wonder if you can say, no, he's not going to be buried here.
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. Well, the First National Bank that was robbed that day still stands in Cisco, although the functioning bank has since been relocated to a new building. The original building now serves as a part of a strip mall on Main Street. If you visit the new location of First National Bank, you can view an ornate painting that was made by a famous Texas artist that depicts the robbery. It includes a man dressed as Santa and three bandits. One of them was wearing a Stetson, which I think is interesting because none of them reportedly were wearing a cowboy hat. I think if it's a bank robbery in West Texas, maybe the artist just drew a cowboy hat on one of them.
Sure.
Yeah. But it is kind of cool. They also have a little glass case there that holds a lot of newspaper clippings, photos, and a few other artifacts of the crime, such as gun belts, guns, spent shells, photos of the time. There's a famous photo of the posse, like as they're getting ready to leave to go chase them down. In 1967, the Texas Historical Commission placed historical markers on the original bank building, the Eastland County Jailhouse, and the utility pole from which Marshall Ratliff was hung. Marshall Ratliff's only child, Dane Ratliff, died earlier this year.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Wonder what he had to say about his father.
Yeah, I couldn't find anywhere where he had made any statements, but...
He must have been so young.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Ratliff probably, was 24.
Yeah, I probably didn't know him at all.
Mm-hmm. Another noteworthy fact, you remember Emma Robinson, the one that was able to testify that Ratliff was in fact Santa Claus?
Mm-hmm.
She later became a highly respected civic leader in Dallas's Highland Park.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I think she should have got a little taste of that dead robber reward money. But to this day, no one was ever paid a single cent for their part in the shooting of the Santa Claus robbers.
Oh, yeah, because technically they did kill one.
Yeah, Lewis Davis.
Yeah.
Guess they couldn't prove that I was, in fact, the person that did the killing shot.
Or maybe they realized it's a little weird to pay somebody from the result of this horrible tragedy.
Yeah, and probably that, hey, we should stop this reward practice. This probably didn't help the situation at all, which it doesn't seem like it did. That's all I have. And that, my friends, is the twisted tale of the Cisco Santa Claus robbery.
Yeah, that's crazy. I mean...
It's a roller coaster, right?
Yeah, and I'm not sure that I've really heard that much about this case, and you'd think that you would have because it's a horrendous crime. So many people died.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like some of these people were just walking down the street.
Yeah, it's bad, man. And one of the things researching this case, I found a lot of people in different types of media who have covered this case, but they didn't necessarily do a very good job with it, and it's kind of taken as like a weird, quirky, wacky case when it's a very bloody, serious case.
Yeah, six people died.
Yeah, and one later after the fact that led to a hanging.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. The jailer.
Yeah, Tom Jones.
The time being what it was, I'm sure we don't have much information about the victims either.
No, not a whole lot. Yeah. I mean, we knew that one of them was a a president of the bank. And then I know that one of the bystanders who was across the street who ended up dying was a student. And they were attending university at the time and were back visiting family for the holidays.
Oh, gosh.
But I didn't have a name or anything to go on. So
yeah.
It's hard when they're back in the 20s, you know?
Yeah, and if nobody was technically charged for any of those other deaths besides the two policemen.
Yep.
Man, what a horrible story.
Merry Christmas, everyone.
That Marshall Ratliff guy seems like a real piece of crap. The commitment to fake insanity like that by just laying there like a dead fish only to trick somebody so you can... Somebody who's been feeding you and taking you to the bathroom for God knows how long just so you can go up behind them and shoot them in the head.
Yep.
Like, what a monster.
Yeah, it's kind of Hannibal Lectery, you know, where you just lay and wait for your moment, get people to kind of forget about how lethal you are.
Yeah.
And then when they're not paying attention, you strike.
You know, I'd be shocked if this never got made into a movie because it sounds...
I think it's almost been made into a movie a couple of times.
I mean, if you told me that this was the plot of a Coen Brothers movie coming out next year, I'd be like, yeah, I mean, that sounds reasonable and kind of awesome.
Or like a Quentin Tarantino movie. Yeah.
But knowing that this is a real thing that happened is just so sad.
Yeah. And that there were so many children that were involved and families that were torn apart during the holidays.
And oh my gosh, all those little girls, I mean, especially the two little girls who were kidnapped. Thank God nothing happened to them, but think of the PTSD and everything from being in that gunfight, seeing people die around you, and then being kidnapped by these guys.
One of the girls, the older one, was pistol whipped in the head because she wouldn't shut up at one point. And she said it took years for her to get over the event and to really mentally recover from her part in it.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, these kind of crimes have ripples that go out away from the epicenter. And I think when people don't really cover them that well and just make them into fun, wacky crimes, it doesn't do any justice to the story or the victims in this case.
Yeah. Well, what a very interesting, if bloody and sad case.
Yeah.
I'm really glad that you covered it. I think it was, I mean, we're a true crime podcast. So as Christmassy as we can get on the show, I think you did a great job.
Oh, thank you. I didn't really plan for this to be a very big, in-depth episode, but the more I looked into it and the more I read, and then once I got a hold of A.C. Green's book, I was like, oh man, I have to do this right.
Yeah. Well, that's what we do on this show.
That's right. And you know what else we do on this show, Aaron?
Maybe a little good news?
Oh, snap. It's like a little present under the tree.
That's right, and that will come to you right after this. So everybody knows the classic Christmas movie, National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation.
Oh, certainly.
Well, there's a very famous scene from that movie where Clark Griswold is up on his roof.
Oh, wait. Is this the one where he's doing the Christmas lights?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so he's up on the roof of his house. He's hanging up Christmas lights. He gets tangled in the lights. He slips. He slides down the roof, barely catches himself on the edge of the roof. And in his panic, he knocks over his ladder. So he's just hanging there trying to figure out what to do.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. He almost takes quite a tumble because it's like a three-story house, right?
Yes. Well, the Heerlein family of North Austin wanted to win their neighborhood Christmas lights competition. So they decided what better way to decorate their house but with a recreation of this famous scene in National Lampoon's.
Oh, no. I can already see this going really poorly.
So they got out a life-size mannequin, dressed it all in clothes from the thrift store to match what Clark was wearing in the movie. So we've got the flannel shirt, the puffy vest, jeans, white sneakers, the cap. They strung it up on the roof of their two-story house, arranging it so it looked like a man dangling dangerously from the ledge of the roof. It honestly looked very realistic. They even had the ladder. They placed it so it looked like it was just out of the reach of the man, and they had it all wrapped up in the Christmas lights and everything.
Oh boy. You gotta be really careful when you employ a full-size mannequin in any kind of holiday decoration.
Yes.
You gotta think twice anytime you do this.
You really do, and I think they learned their lesson.
Okay.
Well, everything was going great until the very next day, when a passerby saw the mannequin and thought it was a real dude about to fall from the roof of his house.
Like, could you imagine being that person and seeing someone seemingly dangling for their life?
So this man rushes up to help this guy, yelling out, "Hey, mister, hold on." He rips the ladder from the string of lights and placed it next to the man hanging from the roof and called out for him to grab the ladder, calling up to him, "Can you reach it?" But the man doesn't respond.
Of course.
So he starts yelling out for help, but this is a neighborhood. It's in the middle of the day. There's nobody around. So he calls the police.
Oh, no.
I mean, this guy was shook. He really thought that there was a man about to fall to his death. He's not responding. Is he dead?
This poor guy.
Well, obviously, the police got there. Everybody figured out that this was all just a Christmas decoration gone wrong, and the Good Samaritan left.
I'm sure the homeowners weren't home at this point.
Well, they come back later. So after hearing about what happened, the family went to their camera feed to find the entire scene was captured on camera. And you can actually watch this entire thing unfold. It's pretty great.
How has this not gone viral at this point?
I think it has. This news story has been everywhere. They got the man's phone number from the camera feed because he gave his phone number to the police officer who arrived at the scene to give him his contact info. This Good Samaritan was retired veteran Alfred Norwood Jr. They were able to call him, thank him for his help, and they even gave him a nice Christmas gift for his troubles and invited him over for hot chocolate.
Oh, okay. What did they give him?
I believe it was a gift card.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Very nice.
The family also later placed a sign on the ladder that read, "Clark G. hanging above is a part of our Christmas display. Please do not call 911.
Wow. That's amazing. Oh, man, you would feel so bad if you were that guy and you had spent all that effort and worry and stress trying to rescue this seemingly endangered individual.
And what about the family? They probably feel kind of dumb,
too. Yeah, it's like, ooh, bad move on our part. We shouldn't have done that.
Well, I can't find a follow-up as to whether or not they actually won their neighborhood Christmas decoration, but I think that they won in all of our hearts.
Hey, North Austin people, if you live in that neighborhood, let us know if they won. We want to know.
But yeah, and I'll definitely post a link to the article where you can see the pictures of this mannequin. Again, looks very lifelike. And you can watch the video feed as well of this poor guy freaking out trying to rescue this man.
Oh, man, that is great. You know, there's another viral video that's going on right now for the holidays. And you know how you were just talking about this the other day, how we're afraid to get packages delivered to the house.
Yeah.
Because there's so many package thieves during the holidays. Well, there is a NASA engineer who made a
glitter bomb.
A glitter bomb. Yeah. Have you seen this?
I heard about it. I didn't watch the video.
Oh, man, you got to watch it. It's amazing. He has cameras inside to film the whole thing and the whole experience that these people have when they open the package trying to see what they stole. And then they get doused with pounds of glitter.
Yeah.
And then a fart bomb goes off, over and over. And they're just like, oh, my God, this is horrible. And they throw it out the car.
Why did this person order this? This is a terrible thing to arrive to your home.
Dude, it's a great 10 minutes of content. I'm just saying. If you've ever had a package stolen, you will feel so good and you'll have a catharsis from this experiment.
Yeah. Well, that's really nice because anybody who does that is a real piece of garbage.
Seriously, man.
It's Christmas, man.
Yeah. Show some heart.
That's right. Be Alfred Norwood Jr.
There you go. Thanks for that little piece of good news, Aaron.
You're welcome. Makes me want to go watch National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. I haven't watched it for a while.
Yeah, it's been a minute. Well, next on the show, we typically move on to recommendations. And this week for recommendations, you know, we've kind of missed a couple of recommendation segments, but we got a good one for you this week. We're talking about some of our friends and fans of the show, Our True Crime Podcast. And this is Cam and Jen. They're a lifelong couple of best friends who love true crime, kind of like you and I. I mean, we're married, but they're just best friends. But you're my best friend. They just spend all their extra time talking about true crime cases, and they decided to make a podcast this year. And even though it's relatively new, I think they're doing a great job, and they have some really great banter and storytelling, and they do really good research. And I think you guys should check this out. To be clear, the show is titled Our True Crime Podcast, and they've done some really interesting cases. They even did a Texas case. They did the case of Levi King, which happened back in the early to mid-2000s, and this was a young man that just snapped and ended up killing a household of individuals, and there was a survivor. There's also some animal violence that happens, but if you're interested in serial killers and what makes a serial killer tick, you should definitely check out that episode. That was one of the first that I listened to. It's really good. And also, this is a perfect time to be doing a promo for Our True Crime Podcast, because they're doing the 12 Nightmares Before Christmas. So Cam and Jen, I don't know if they thought this through when they first did it. I know they've been stressing out about it, and it's really tough to put out a show every day. But for 12 straight days during December, they're putting out 12 different nightmares, horrible cases, you know, very dark and tragic cases for your Christmas season. And some of them are really interesting. I would highly recommend it. There's some survivor stories in there. There's some really good true crime. There's some myths and legends. And they kind of do like we do, where they alternate back and forth who's hosting that week. And then they have a couple of collaborative series episodes. So check that out. While we're on break, I think you can binge some Our True Crime Podcast.
All right, sounds good. So let's listen to their promo.
Friends tired of hearing you talk about serial killers?
While you're at a dinner party, have you randomly blurted out the odds of being murdered by a complete stranger?
Does Netflix only recommend documentaries on true crime and murder?
If you've answered yes to one or more of these questions,
come over and sit at our friends table.
I'm Cam.
And I'm Jen.
And we are the co-host of Our True Crime Podcast.
And you can listen to us every Wednesday wherever you download your podcasts.
See you on Wednesday.
Oh, bye-bye.
Love ya.
All right. Thanks, guys, for tuning in to the after show. We are going to be doing our final 5-star reviews that we're going to be reading on the show.
We're going to pour through them. We're going to hit them real fast.
Yeah, we have quite a few to get to, but we want to go ahead and end this. It'll end the year quite nicely, yeah. I think. But before we get to that, just remember, everyone, you can follow us on our social media. We're on Twitter at ACNC Podcast, on Instagram at All Crime No Cattle. You can drop us a line at allcrimenocattle@gmail.com. Also, be sure to search us out on Patreon if you would like some extra goodies, ad-free listening, all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and support the show.
Go ahead and check us out on our Threadless shop at threadless.com/allcrimenocattle. We have lots of really cool stuff. I've ordered my leggings. I'm so excited for my leggings to get here.
I'm so happy to design them. People have been buying them up left and right. I think they're giving them away as gifts. They're going shopping for Christmas gifts in the leggings.
Yeah, going to go work out. Yeah. Do some like deadlifts in them. It's going to look good.
CrossFit, perfect for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't do any of that. I'm going to be real honest. I'm going to go like to the grocery store in them, but.
Hey, we got pod bods.
We do have pod bods. I want that as a turd shirt.
A turd shirt.
I want that as a t-shirt. Pod bod.
Hashtag pod bod.
All right, let's get this over with.
All right. Our first one comes from Australia, and that's from Sue G. And they say enjoyable 5 stars. Just came across this podcast, and I'm already addicted since the very first episode. You guys are great, and I love the theme music. Keep up the great work, as we appreciate it in heaps. From Western Australia.
Ah, thank you. It is a lot of work.
It is.
But we love doing it just for you, Australia.
Yep. Good on you, mate.
Oh, I was hoping you weren't going to do it.
I did.
We always get yelled at whenever we do our voices.
Don't yell at me. Dude, I love Australia. We want to go there and go on a walkabout and travel your lands and see all your sights.
Oh, yes.
Bibliophile 4 says, the best. Listening to this podcast is you in the living room of two good friends who are the masters of true crime storytelling and researching. Pet the dogs and get comfortable for a wickedly good time.
Wow, that was nice. Yeah, I really liked that. That should be our little blurb for our show.
Yeah,
I love it.
Our elevator pitch.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Bibliophile 4. Rebecca Sotelo says, awesome podcast. Many of these cases are well known, but the narrators tell them in an entirely new perspective. The empathy and intimacy that they share with victims is unique and unparalleled. They also give a very human glimpse into the backgrounds of the killers. Thank you. That was them. But thank you, Rebecca, for submitting that review. We appreciate it.
Yeah, very much.
Good, good, good says, H-Town loves you. You guys are awesome. Everything about this podcast screams 5 stars. I'm so glad I found this podcast. Great hosts, well-researched episodes, and the good news stories at the end leave you feeling a little bit better about the world despite the otherwise dark content. Keep them coming, guys. P.S. Houston loves Dallas-Fort Worth, even though we do, in fact, believe that they are the same place. Winky face.
Yeah, you do, for sure. Oh, that's nice to know, though.
Oh, Houston. We love you, Houston. You stay soggy down there. Oh, speaking of Houston, Murder City says, a staple in every Texan's playlist. Murder City is the true crime podcast that is excellent and you should check out, and they are from Houston. If you live in Texas, you should be subscribed to this show. Shay and Aaron put together a wonderful show that I've been listening to since the very beginning. It only gets better. These two are wonderful people, both on and off the air, and I have no doubts that their star will continue to rise. Thank you for all your support. And Murder City wishes nothing but the best for you. Signed, B. Thank you, B.
Thank you, B. Yeah, B and CC are lovely people. We met them. Hopefully we'll be able to meet them again in the future.
Yeah, I hope they come to the meetup in March for the Texas Podcast Union over in Fort Worth.
Yeah, and to hear a little bit more about them, we did do an interview with them quite a few episodes ago. So
yeah, check that episode out.
Check that out and go check out their podcast as well.
Yeah, they're great. All right. Aiko San via iTunes tells us, Road Warrior. Oh. I travel for my job and spend hours on the road every day. Your podcast has made my traveling so much more enjoyable. I've binged every episode available over the last week. Y'all are funny and thorough. Thanks for the great podcast. Well, thanks for the great review, Aiko.
Yeah, thank you. I love that it's called Road Warrior.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite movies.
Yeah, I got a Mad Max situation going on. I would love if you decorated your truck like a vehicle in Mad Max.
Oh, man.
Please do it and then send us a picture. If you didn't know, Shay and I went as characters from Beyond the Thunderdome.
Oh, yeah,
I went as
did.
Tina Turner. It was fantastic. My outfit was one of my favorites that I've ever made for Halloween. It was
You had the
great.
Wig. You had those raised shoulder pads and like the chainmail mesh over the whole thing. And
yeah.
You had blonde hair at the time.
Well, no, I had that
wig. Oh, you
wig.
Had the wig. You had the wig. But it looked like Tina Turner's hair. And then I was one of your road warriors.
Yeah, and I would go around being like, come on, raggedy man.
Yeah, it was pretty great. Haha 6756 says, I love this series. Very well put together. I am from Fort Worth as well. Any possibility y'all can cover the Cullen Davis murders? Thank y'all. Oh, man, this has been one of our most requested cases to cover.
Of course, it's probably one of the most famous true crime cases in Fort Worth.
Yep.
Definitely considering doing it sometime in the future. Obviously, it's a really big case.
Yeah, it might be perfect for a Lone Star Lunatic case, like a multi-parter.
Maybe a multi-parter for sure, because there is a lot of information to get to.
Well, it's on our list and we appreciate the review. Haha. Miles Teaches says, hello from Sweet Home, Oregon. Ooh, I went to Oregon as a child once. Enjoying you guys. So funny, yet very kind to victims and their families. I am a fan. Laughy face, Peggy.
Aw, Peggy, thank you very much. We appreciate it. We really hope to get that across to all of you, because some people accuse us of maybe not doing that, which I don't understand.
That's our biggest thing about this show. It's one of.
Yeah. So thank you, Peggy, for getting it.
Donna207 says, super true crime with an odd title. Love the hosts, great voices with the right touch of banter. Super content. Really enjoy this podcast. Up There is one of the best true crime podcasts around. Wow.
Wow. Well, thank you very much.
Sorry you don't like the odd title, Donna, but just Google all hat, no cattle, and you'll kind of get it.
That's right. It's a Texas thing.
It's all about being from the Lone Star State. Bruce Fluffy Toes, great name, says, fabulous. I've listened to only 7 episodes and I love them. The crimes are all new to me so far. Keep up the good work. What's the music at the start?
That lovely tune.
A little ditty.
was something that we actually just purchased online. We went through a lot of different options. We wanted something that was kind of Texas-y, kind of tongue-in-cheek, a little silly. I don't know today, honestly, if I would have necessarily picked it, to be completely honest.
Really?
But everybody likes it, so hey, that's good. Well, most people like it.
I love it.
Okay, well, I'm glad you do.
Some people think it's really hammy.
But... that's kind of my issue with it as well. Like, I can see where people come from with that. But the whole thing is it was supposed to be kind of a representation of us and also mm-hmm. us kind of going along with the whole Texas stereotype.
Yes.
And kind of joking with that stereotype and saying, this is kind of a silly thing.
Yeah, it matched us. It matched the show. It matched the title.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Well, Ramamba says, Texas podcast forever. I love this podcast, which was recommended by a friend because of the in-depth research on the crimes committed in my neck of the woods. Keep up the great work, Inspector Aaron and Detective Shea Butter.
Oh,
you got a call out.
I like that. Thank you very much. And thank your friend as well.
Lana says, not an Eagles fan. Even though I'm from Philadelphia and Aaron dislikes all of us, I am going to prove how nice we can be by giving an honest review. I love this show. As a true crime fan, I've listened to so much that I get sick of hearing about the same old cases. Hearing about Aaron's love of Bones is refreshing and educational. Shea Butter's okay, too. Now for my obligatory cow joke. How do you count cows?
I don't know.
Well, the calculator.
Oh, perfect. Well, thank you, Lana. Believe me, we have been yelled at aplenty for those comments that you were referring to so badly that we just went ahead and cut them from the episode.
Yep.
Which is the only post. Like, once we produce an episode and it's done, we have not ever gone back and done anything to that episode yet.
Yeah.
That's the first time that we ever did that, just because people mm-hmm. got really mad. We did that at a time where we had very few listeners and we're Cowboys fans. We thought it would come across as a joke, which is how it was meant. A lot of people got really mad at us.
I thought that being a member of the NFC East and the NFL,
yeah,
with the Philadelphia
would get
Eagles, knowing that they're our arch nemesis, I mean, we're all arch nemesis.
Of course, yeah.
But they would get the fact that we were just ribbing each other.
Exactly. Which I would expect a Eagles fan to do if the Cowboys could ever do anything. Maybe if we make the playoffs. But who knows? Yeah. Considering we just got shut out. So.
Boy, they took it real personal.
They were very mad at us.
Sorry, Philly.
So, Lana, thank you for understanding and loving us anyway.
Yeah, you proved us wrong. There are great Philadelphians out there. And we appreciate every one of you.
That's right.
Oh boy, another interesting username. Raw Dog Villain says, outstanding. I don't know if I want Raw Dog Villain, like, really telling me how great I am, but thank you. Love this podcast. Totally addictive. Great cases covered. Makes me want to do my own research. Brilliant.
You should.
Okay, so Miranda Tree is up next, and she says, favorite true crime podcast. I absolutely love you guys. I think that what you're doing is great. Bringing attention to cold cases and lesser known cases, even just breaking down solved cases, is really amazing. I'm a huge fan and I'd love it if you did a case from Wiley, Texas. We had an axe murder in the 80s by a scorned lover who happened to be an elementary school teacher. We also had a murderer a few years ago who was a teenage boy who was killed by his classmates, people I actually grew up with, over a girl. He was strangled and left dumped by a mall in Garland. It was horrible and really shook the town. I'd love it if you guys could touch on one or both of those cases. Thank you so much. Keep doing what you do. We all really appreciate you too.
Well, thank you. Those do sound both like interesting cases, and we'll try to look into them and see if they are a good fit for the show. Thank you for the suggestions.
And that, my friends,
is that
the
it?
End of our iTunes reviews. But keep them coming. Keep delivering them to us, and if you send us a very interesting one or a great one, we'll probably read it on the show anyway.
Yeah, you have something funny to say or just something really sweet or whatever, we'll go ahead and read, you know, a couple of those every once in a while when it suits our fancy.
Maybe once every quarter of the year, we can pick out our favorite iTunes reviews and read them at the end of an episode.
Yeah, maybe something like that. Yeah. Sounds pretty good.
Okay.
As always, we'd like to thank our patrons who contribute to us at the topmost level, our dear, wonderful Texas Rangers. We have, of course, Lisa L., who is now our best friend.
Oh, yeah. We've hung out with Lisa. She's gotten the special VIP treatment.
That's right. But Lisa has another person on her team.
Uh-oh.
And that is Mel T.
Oh, Mel T's in the house.
Technically, Mel T hasn't paid for this month yet. But, I mean, Mel T, you're doing great things. And yeah. We decided to just go ahead and give you a bump early.
This is the thing you get when you sign up to be a Texas Ranger. You get special perks and bonuses and mentions just whenever, all the time, even when you haven't paid.
That's right.
Yeah. Thank you, Mel T.
Yeah. Thank both of you. And of course, thank all of our patrons. We love you guys very much.
Love you, Lisa. Well, folks, we've reached the end of that dusty trail. We're back in the hovel here. In the studio of ACNC headquarters, we've got one dog that's completely asleep, one that is fighting off the slumber. The eyes are just barely open, slowly closing. But we need to go eat dinner, so that's what we're going to do. Hope you guys have a great night, and we'll see you in a couple of days for the anniversary episode.
Yeah, very soon. And if you decide not to check that out, that's cool too. We'd like you to, though. Go ahead and listen to it. But if you don't, have a really great Christmas, Happy New Year, Happy Holidays, Hanukkah. All of that really good stuff. And we will see you in 2019. Can you believe it's already 2019?
Can you believe we already did a year of podcasting?
It is mind-blowing.
We love you guys. Thank you guys for everything. We really appreciate everyone who listens to the show. We'll see you in a couple of days. And as always, crime is bigger in Texas, y'all. Adios.
Bye.